Sorry, we were supposed to do that. All right, hence we get a Richard's fourth axiom. Still, something I wrote years ago and it still holds. Preparing for the cost of chronic illness is not simply a part of a good financial plan, it is the true test of that plan. As far as I'm concerned, this is the biggie. Many, many advisors, it's the reason that I don't, you know, you can't be all things to all people, part of the reason that I don't spend a lot of my time in portfolio management and the wonderful skills, very important skills, of learning how to help people accumulate dollars and accumulate wealth is because that's a separate expertise from being able to figure out how to do this. Being able to deal with what is likely, in the light of our current circumstances, the single largest challenge to their financial plans that they will have. Will be the cost of their chronic care. I do so, I'm just giving you some quick guidelines here in the next, hopefully 5 minutes or so, of how to plan for that care. And honestly, it is multidimensional. As you have hopefully heard all of these factors, of the finances certainly, but also of family, of daily function, not medical diagnosis, but what can you do, what can you not do, and what challenge do we have to it. And also this whole issue of your core beliefs, your faith, hopefully given to you by grace from the Lord in Jesus Christ, affects directly what plans and what choices that you make into the future. So hopefully all of those are... I have a set of four steps that I take. And they're there in the outline. I commend you to look at them, but let me quickly describe what they are. The four steps I do when I'm working with a family... is to, number one, replace anxiety with information. That's hopefully some of what's going on even this morning. Second is to de-stress the decision-making process itself. Now, I have a couple of methods for being able to do that. The next is, frankly, you got other things to do with your life. We got to simplify the finances. We've got to make this, to get this thing, if not on autopilot, on something where I can look at the instrumentation and know that the thing's flying. Because I've got other things that I need to be attending to during that period of time. And then lastly, part of my planning always involves that the person who is acting as the caregiver, the fiduciary, whether it's a direct caregiver or it's the family member or other party that's looking out after these finances, looking out after the needs, acting on behalf of the care recipient, also make sure that we take care of putting your house in order. And that we make sure that you're not going to become the weak link in this particular care system. Let me walk through each a little bit more quickly, a little bit more detail, but quickly. Replacing anxiety with information. First things first is let's make sure we know what we're talking about medically. I am a strong, strong proponent of the comprehensive, interdisciplinary geriatric assessment movement, often based around teaching hospitals, sometimes unnecessarily expensive, sometimes redoing what docs can do over time in the community. Don't get me wrong. But I think the ability to stop and take a snapshot and make sure that we are aware of where we are comprehensively. All the meds. Not the three that are prescribed by this doc, the other three that are prescribed by that doc, and the six that are prescribed by the other six docs. Okay? I mean, someplace where we pull the whole thing together and say, where are you right now? Is there redundancy in how we're treating things? Is there a plan? Is there a priority list? Do we know where we are right now? And this comes from the following experience. Yes, I'm biased because I used to work at one of these kinds of places many, many, many years ago. But my principal bias comes in the following area. I've had far too many cases where I've had folks who came and we were building a plan on the basis of progressive dementia, for instance, from a financial standpoint, from a care systems. They were maybe already at a care facility and nobody had actually done what you consider to be the basic tests that the National Institute on Health or the CDC or the World Health Organization said you're supposed to do to be able to diagnose the problem in the first place. We frankly did not know, is this actually a dementia that might be caused by multi-infarct? Is this these weird psychiatric symptoms that we're getting, is that because it's a completely different disease? Or is that because we're giving a medication that's worsening things? Or because we need to give a medication that makes things better? But in either case, we did not have that ability. How can we move forward legally, financially, and family arrangements? How can we move forward if we don't know exactly what it is that we're dealing with from a healthcare standpoint to the degree that we can know? Okay? Second is appreciating getting the information that's out there about what sources are available in the community. I described for you before some of those home-based programs that are related to retirement communities. I looked based on your face, that looked like new information to a lot of folks here. But yet some of the better, more elegant ones are actually just a stone's throw from where I'm standing right now. So there are services and resources that are out there. They're well known to those of us inside of the community, but we all talk to each other all the time. You know, we know each other's websites. You may not. And frankly, if you're doing this in the way that most of us are now seeking out information in the age of the search engine, you're probably getting two or three pages of paid advertisers who bought that spot first. So if you find things where it's like, whoa, that's exactly what I was looking for. I'm looking for information about a nursing home. And I found the .com or .org or whatever. So like right there, boy, I immediately got it. Get down to the bottom of that first page and find out who it is that provided that information to you. More likely than not, it is not a federal agency. It's not a state agency. It's not some nonprofit advocacy group. It's somebody who's trying to sell you something. It may be good information, but just please be aware of the interest. But the way in which the search engines have now gone, we've gone in two different ways. One, you're going to get a lot of advertised space first. That may or may not be what you're looking for. Two, if you're using one of the search engines that actually is based on all the cookies they left on your computer that are sitting around telling them what you searched for before, they're going to try to give you the answer they think you want. Not the answer necessarily that you need or that is correct, but the one that based on everything else you've ever looked at before, you would want. And they're parsing out your data using one of their search mechanisms, mathematical search mechanisms, to be able to do that. So available comprehensive understanding of community resources would be the next piece of the information. Quality and cost of the residential options. We did some of that even here, and I hope that was enlightening to some of you. And then eligibility for the public benefits, you know, particularly for Medicaid, for the VA programs, to make sure that is there something out there that I'm eligible for? And if not, why not? And if not now, maybe later? Second piece of de-stressing is to de-stress the decision-making. And the first piece of this that's most important to me is to get a legal structure in place. I want to touch briefly upon the notion of proxy powers or powers of attorney. In short, guys, there's two major instruments that all, frankly, all of us, but particularly those of us as we get older or have a higher potential for frailty, need. The one is called a durable power of attorney for healthcare. Any of you who've been in the hospital of late know that that's, if you didn't have one when you walked in, somebody's jamming it in front of your face on a little clipboard quickly upon your arrival. Because they don't want the liability and responsibility. They want to make sure that you've named somebody of your own. There is a standardized form in the state of Ohio. I'm usually not a big proponent of standardized fans. I changed my mind on this one. I kind of like the idea that the emergency room physician knows exactly what's on page two in the middle of the paragraph. I like them to have the same format, because those are the human beings, the EMTs, the ER docs, so on and so forth, as quickly as possible to know what it is I said I wanted not, and most importantly, who's the human being I said you're supposed to call? They may not be my spouse. They may not be my eldest born child. They may not be the first child that you can get on the telephone. That may exonerate you from your liability as an adequate show of good faith effort. I had a specific person that I wanted on there, and I had a specific reason for why, and I had a pecking order, and I want to make sure that it's very clear to you who is the first, the second, and the third person I would pick to make decisions for me if I became incapacitated and could not make decisions for myself. That is a durable power of attorney for healthcare. It is durable because it means it still survives. The power I gave to this person continues on even if I'm incapacitated. It is a proxy power given to another person, okay? It does not exist by definition unless I'm incapacitated. So as much as there might be times where my wife would want this authority, it's not possible for me to be on the gurney, you know, being brought down, looking at the fluorescence over the top in the hospital, saying, don't cut off the leg, don't cut off the leg. And she's like, cut off the leg, take his tongue while you're at it. So the you know, only you have to have, it only springs into authority upon the time that you have that incapacity. The second document is called a durable general power of attorney. Sometimes they'll use the general word. It's basically the authority that you give to someone to manage your financial affairs. They can't transact legal documents as though they were you. But within the parameters of the legal documents, they can go ahead and do your banking, your finances. They can act as your fiduciary. Everything from paying your bills to signing you up for changing the beneficiaries on your life insurance policies, potentially. So it's a lot of power. It's a lot of authority. There is a great deal of debate that I believe has to come down to the family, has to come down to an individual family-by-family decision about whether you give someone that authority immediately. Very easy to use then, right? Right? You don't want to be in a situation where you're trying to get money out of the bank to pay the bills, to take care of things, to keep the house out of foreclosure, and you have to go get a medical statement from the physician to show that this person's incapacitated for you to be able to use your power of attorney. So it's a little less cumbersome to have one that's effective immediately. But I remind people when they sign those, your daughter is now you. Your son is now you. You could be having this conversation with me, and if you've given a durable power of attorney to that person, they could be, as we're speaking right now, they could be putting a mortgage on your house if they wish to. So be aware of the authorities that you're given. To my mind, partly for that reason, partly because of the specificity that we can place into it, a durable general power of attorney should be done with an attorney. Often part of my role and part of the reason that we've developed the Center for Elder Care Finance in the way that we have is to make sure that as I come to know a family and I understand their values and I understand their family structure, I can now take that piece of information and make sure they get to the right attorney, that we can construct the documents in a way that is befitting those values, befitting that structure that I've learned in the midst of the rest of the assessment. But it's an important document to have. It ain't boilerplate in that regard. Okay? The second piece of distressing the decision-making that I think is terribly important is to make sure that before it's too late to do so, you discuss end-of-life plans. Advanced directives, and again, there's levels of complexity in all of this about what is a DNR. Used to be one thing that we talked about. Now there's lots of discussions about, well, wait a second, I want this, but I don't want this, but I do want this, and under this circumstance, I want this. There's a lot of different layers, and so when you talk to somebody, particularly in the healthcare environment, talk to somebody about what a DNR is, you may discover that you're discussing a different concept. What they at their institution refer to as a do not resuscitate order, it may have multiple levels beyond actually, you know, jumping on top of their chest and pounding. Okay, but I'm going beyond that. You know, some people choose to have a written document incidentally that supersedes the power of the person that they've placed in authority as their proxy, that says, these are the things I want done or don't want done, under no condition. That document has more weight than the person. If the circumstances change over time, so if in other words, if I said under the following conditions, I do not want antibiotics if I get an infection, if I am ever progressively demented and pass the ability of personal capacity in that regard. Okay, sounds good. How very Spartan of me. The problem is now, when I'm actually that sweet guy sitting in the care facility, and frankly, my highest priorities of that particular day are the fact that ice cream really tastes good, and whoever that nice young lady is in the white uniform, when she leans in toward me, she smells nice. That's my highest priorities. I'm not bothering anybody. I'm a nice guy. Okay, me, at that point, I'm no longer living anywhere close to the values of the person that I was when I signed that document. But the document says now, don't give me any antibiotics if I get an infection. So it's a little dicey about the role of these living will documents. Should they be used? Should they not be used? I know that you need a good proxy. I don't know necessarily, depending upon who those people are in your world and how your world's going, whether that document is actually useful for you to have at all, or whether, frankly, you'd want to shred the one that you have right now if you start to think about what its potential implications are. Doesn't matter, okay? Last piece is funeral planning. A lot of times we end up encouraging people to do their funeral planning because it's part of the financial planning around their getting public benefits. I actually have come to the conclusion, no, let's just do this. It reduces a burden to our children. It also gives an enormous expression. I mean, think about it, guys. I mean, having been a parent, many of you parents, I mean, to be able to get the last word, okay? So no matter what else, all those people who out of nothing else but social obligation have to show up, I'm going to darn well make sure they hear the gospel of Jesus Christ at least one last shot at it, because they got no choice. I'm in the box, man. They gotta listen at that point in time. Planning the funeral goes far beyond planning the finances, but it includes the finances. The other element of de-stressing the decision-making has to do with family issues. Obviously, identifying the parents' values is essential. This, there is no place, you know, let's be clear. When you look at the data on financial exploitation, including financial or exploitation in general, and abuse of older adults, but especially financial exploitation, the target principally does not point, it does sadly point toward a lot of folks in my industry. The target principally points toward family members. Family members who place their own interests above those of the person that they were responsible for at one time or another. So it is terribly important that we be very clear whose values are guiding this and how we're going to get to the end results. It's especially true if the capacity of that older person is in question or we're starting to lose that capacity. Assigning reasonable roles to family members. In other words, we got to go beyond that conversation that says, yeah, I love my mom, I'll do anything for my mom. Okay, let's talk some specifics here. Because my gut tells me your sister is going to end up carrying this entire thing here. So how about we actually nail down reasonable roles that are actually going to get done? I'd rather have less platitudes and promises out of you. I'd rather have your execution of even a small portion of the responsibilities here, timely, responsible, reliable in that particular area. And we'll figure out how to buy the rest, do the rest, take care of the rest. Often, as you can imagine, there's plenty of potential for conflict of interest with children. The same person, in many cases, who has to make decisions about how much we're going to spend on mom's care is also potentially a beneficiary of that mom's estate. If the dollars don't get spent, there may be more dollars to make their way down. You can't miss that. And we just kind of live with that potential for a conflict of interest in all this. It needs to get disclosed, and we need to make sure that there's an open dialogue about this. Many families hire my services specifically to run a family meeting, to get this stuff together. Often when I'm consulting to an estate planning attorney, I might be brought in so that we can take the plans that were made with the older person or the older couple and disclose them out to the family so that everybody's on the same page, so that there's no surprises in life, that there's the opportunity to be able to do that. Simplifying the finances, everybody needs a budget. Not just folks that are, you know, are cutting it close on a monthly basis in terms of their expenses. Everybody needs a budget. Why? Because it ain't your money. It's God's money. You're a steward of this money. So keeping an account of it and making sure, and I'm not saying that that means that it's not a budget that includes an awful lot of fun stuff in there. But the accounting for dollars and making sure that you are using the resources in the way that you've asked the guy who actually owns the money whether he wants you to use it this way is a standard operating procedure for a Christian. It also happens to be a wise thing to do and, frankly, will make your life a lot easier when all of a sudden those expenses start jamming up because of healthcare problems. There are specific asset allocations for folks who are dealing with chronic care. There's ways in which we need to modify personal assets in the portfolio to be able to address that. In brief, any portfolio, anytime you hold assets in investment, you're going to have to look at factors like what kind of return or yield I can get on it, right? The upside. You're going to have to look on how safe it is. How much risk did I take to do that? Is it safe? And you're going to have to look at how liquid, how quickly can I get it if I need it? Short answer, all right? So return, safety, liquidity. Every place you can ever go to park your money, you'll get 2 out of 3 at best. There is no 3 out of 3. Doesn't exist anywhere in the world of finance. So if the guy who's coming to you and saying, I got this great portfolio of stocks, recognize the fact that they are fully liquid, they may have a wonderful upside potential, but if the stock market goes down, more likely than not, a bunch of those are going with it. And you've seen that. If the person comes to you and says, no, I hate those stock things. I'm going to show you this annuity, okay? Because the annuity now, that's going to protect your money. And the short answer is, you know what? It may have a much more limited upside in terms of its yield, but some. It's maybe wonderfully safe, but you can't get more than 10 or 20% out of it per year for the next 10 years. It's pretty illiquid. So pick 2 out of 3 and have a portfolio that best reflects your priorities. But for folks that deal with where I'm dealing with, some of those variables are so much more important than others. Liquidity often being a big one that most folks don't normally think about. Many older adults, by the time they get to me, are used to a highly illiquid life. They just don't need it. Lots of CDs, lots of annuities, lots of money locked up in their home equity. And now all of a sudden we need bucks fast. And we're having to really work to try to remove some of these things from their illiquid position without too much damage. I believe it is legitimate to plan to use public benefits. I made reference toward that before in terms of VA or Medicaid. But I need to give at least one commentary from the perspective of biblical morality around some of the dangers involved in that. I have colleagues that I have great respect for in a whole number of different ways that actively have as their practice what they refer to as Medicaid planning. In many cases, those are attorneys that are actively involved in assisting people within the limits of the law to transfer assets out of their ownership in order to be able to become eligible for public benefits. And they will know many strategies, some of which you've seen, anything from gifting to irrevocable trusts to half-loaf strategies that may involve annuities, lots of different creative, interesting, and I go to the same seminars they do, to be able to learn how to do all those different kinds of techniques. What I'm saying to you all as the body of Christ is you are citizens of the United States of America. You have to live within the lawful rules. And if an attorney comes to you, and their moral obligation as an attorney, Christian or otherwise, their moral obligation is to make sure that every available option to you, they are acting in your best interest to find every available option within the law that is available to you. And woe to them if they don't fulfill that role as the attorney. They have to act as your agent. They're not acting as an agent of the public. They're not acting as an agent of the community. They're acting as an agent of yours to give you every lawful opportunity within the parameters of the law. And so if they said to you, you know what, we can take this money out, live on this money, park that away, 60 months from now it doesn't even exist from the perspective of Medicaid, and then we'll file for Medicaid. I will tell you, if they're doing that correctly and they were doing it above the law, they actually are obliged to show you how to do that because that's their job as an attorney. Good for them. I'm also telling you, you're asking your neighbors to pay for your mom's nursing home bill so that you can have an estate. And at some level, we do have to at least start to think about this as some kind of game of musical chairs. In other words, who ends up paying their own bill? The one that didn't think to go get some planning. And we need to stop and ask ourselves. We're not there. There's no discussions. I can go, and still even to this date, I can hit a local Christian bookstore, if there are any Christian bookstores any longer, or I can go online, and I can see lots and lots of books about morally how to raise my children or how to deal with adolescents. I don't find very much out there that talks about morally, where are we as a body of Christ on this issue of asking somebody else to pay our care bills because the law affords us the opportunity to. I'm not saying necessarily that it's wrong. I'm saying we've got to start to struggle this through, and you will have to, like anything else in your life as a believer, you will have to bring it in prayer before the Lord. You will have to seek the counsel of others. You will have to make sure that as you seek the scriptures, that this is in line with what you believe to be right. And make sure that we're scrutinizing it. And not fall back on, well, it's just like the tax code. You know, I don't have to pay any more taxes than I'm obliged to pay. Now, I wouldn't want you to have to pay any more taxes than you have to pay. Not really. These are dollars that actually someone else, there is a common here. And it's worth us saying, wait a second, morally, where are we on this issue? So all I'm saying is, that Christian or otherwise, when you seek counsel for planning for public benefits, make sure that the counsel that you're getting includes this element of biblical morality. And be aware that the person, even if the person is also a follower of Jesus like you are, if this person is an attorney, they're obliged to give you the legal options that are there. And you want them to act as that kind of agent. That may not be the whole answer that you're looking for and the whole answer that God's calling you toward. Okay, caregivers, put your house in order. Simply put, if your situation falls apart, you're not going to be able to be much use to a parent in this situation. That, to me, includes your own personal retirement planning, your own personal finances, getting that stuff together. One of the most common activities for me when someone comes to me at the Center for Elder Care Finance is my then referring them to a colleague who I believe is a good fit for them for their own financial retirement planning and financial planning in a way that we're able to talk with each other, particularly if they're acting as a fiduciary for my client who might be their parent. And it's really important. You know, the image that always comes to me that I think is most helpful, any of us who fly in the airplane on a regular basis, right? You drone it out now. You don't even hear it any longer. It's that person up there that's in front of you that's doing these little motions like this, you know, and stuff, and telling you where all the exits are. And then they do this motion, right? And nobody on the recording is going to know what I'm talking about. But they do the motion like they're putting a mask to their face. And the language is always, in the unlikely event of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, the mask will drop from above you. Please be sure to affix your own mask before assisting the person next to you. Now, why would they give that instruction? Because unconscious people are not particularly good with helping with the little kid that's sitting next to them, right? So the idea is, you do. It's just wisdom. It's not selfishness. You got to make sure that if what you need to do is get to that gym X number of times a week, you got to walk with your spouse because that's when you pray together. You got to do the things you need to do to keep your life together as a caregiver. That's in mom's best interest. That's in dad's best interest. You need to do this. This ain't a sprint. You need to do whatever you need to do to be able to keep this marathon going for as long as it takes. And that might mean a rest stop. That might mean making sure that you're building in your life. And one of those areas that I've seen it most fall apart is the personal financial life of the parties who are acting as proxies and fiduciaries. And secondly, the fact that few people see the reality of the cost of long-term care and the gravity of this situation, as well as the person who's helping their parent go through it or just go through it. So I do think, whether it's relevant or not, remember, not everybody needs a long-term care insurance policy. Everybody needs a plan. And every plan needs to have an analysis of whether a long-term care insurance policy makes sense. And so I believe that that's something that 56-year-olds, 40, 50, 60-year-olds should be looking to say, how am I going to deal with this problem so that I'm not in this situation for my kids necessarily that I'm dealing with right now with my parents. The goal ultimately is to be in a position where you have enough of your own personal life on autopilot and in a simple enough situation that, you know, as Ron Blue of Kingdom Advisors describes, he said the goals of financial planning are to be able to be free to give, free to go. I would actually amend that in the case of a caregiver, free to give, free to go, free to grieve. This is a tough part of life. And the last thing you want to be doing is getting caught, mired in the details of this and not giving yourself the opportunity to say, Lord, why do you have me here? I don't doubt you as a providential God. I don't doubt that, frankly, you are working. I love you. You love me. I know I'm called according to your purpose. But this does not feel good. So I need to have the time to come before the Lord, sovereign God of the universe, who understands everything, sees all things of the future, and say, help me understand, at least in my heart, if I can't in my mind, how are you working together all things for good for me here again? Where is it I am right now? And I think sometimes the caregivers I deal with sometimes don't always make the wisest decisions for their parents because, frankly, they haven't spent enough time in that work before the Lord to get peace with that issue. And problems start to become something to attack rather than something to stop and say, help me, Lord, what's the wise thing to do here? Ultimately, in the planning, if there's any simple principle I can give to you, it would be Richard's fifth and last axiom from Proverbs 16. We make our plans. The mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs our steps. It would be easy in these awful situations to fall to some wrong theological notion that God doesn't get it. He's missing it. He let it go. I wish I could go there, guys. It would be a nice, easy, intellectual answer for you. It's not true. This God has chosen for reasons of his choosing to hold the treasure of the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ in a jar of clay, in the fragile vessel that we have in our bodies and our minds and the little capillaries in our brain. And he has chosen to embed the most important thing ever in the history of the world inside of that frailty so that he can boast of the glory all going to him. I don't get it. I don't understand it. But I absolutely can assure you it's true. So, for those of you that need to leave, I've gone 7 minutes over. For those who've not, I want to address the questions that you've brought to me to the degree that I've not. Okay? So if you want to split, otherwise we're probably going until quarter after to address these questions. Your call. I will take no offense. People probably told kids they were going to be home by 12:15. You're not going to make it unless you split right now. Great. Thank you. You betcha. You betcha. No, no. Go take some of Vicky's food as you're going. So, okay. Getting a little more granular on a couple of these issues. The questions that were asked of me for the purpose of the recording are, talk to me about powers of attorney, wills, and trusts. I talked about powers of attorney because I think that relates to everybody. I held back on wills and trusts because for some it's more important than for others, okay? You have heard it said that everybody needs a will. I'm not about to negate that notion, incidentally. But let me explain why, okay? Everybody needs a plan for what's going to happen to their stuff after they're dead. Okay, and the reason for that is because it causes a real hassle to the people that you leave it to if you don't. You don't need a bit of it. Okay, it's not your hassle. It's somebody else's hassle. Okay, so for that reason, I wholly agree with estate planning colleagues that everybody needs a will. But let's stop and think for a second of what does the will steer? What, as an instrument of distribution, what is it that goes with the will? Okay, and is it everything? And the short answer is no. It's all the assets that aren't otherwise directed by something else. So if, for instance, you have a living trust, you have a revocable or living trust, you place these assets into what basically amounts to a shadow instrument. Me and my shadow. Right, and so there's me, and I've created this thing that runs alongside me that is not me, but is just like me. It follows along with my social security number. It has my stated intentions. It's only for me. I still own the stuff that's in it. But it's held in a different place. That's my living trust. Okay? The living trust can have all the kind of rules I want to. And trust me, there are some crazy ones out there. Some might be as simple as give my money all to my kids in equal shares. And I don't care what kind of money it is, just lump it all together and give the fair economic value of it to each of my kids. Well, that's pretty simple. You may not have needed the trust for that one, okay? Or it could be only give it to those kids who, after walking on their hands for 60 paces, are willing to come to the top of a rooftop and declare that their mother was the kindest person ever that existed on the planet. You could put that rule in there as well. And if you don't believe me, I always laugh because there is, next to the building that my son works in Manhattan, there is a hotel that shall remain nameless with the name of a woman who shall remain nameless who gave a substantial amount of a multi-million dollar net worth to her dog. Okay? And so it can be done. You can put whatever rules you want to inside of the trust. Okay? But the courts didn't necessarily hold that up, but we'll see how that all goes. So it depends in all of this. Is that that there's multiple means of being able to execute getting stuff out to somebody that I want to get it to. The will is almost in many ways the last line of defense. If it's made it all the way to the probate court, and it's at that level, then the will matters. You don't want to end up at the probate court with them saying, okay, so where's the will? And you say, we never got one. The person died intestate. Then at that point, you're probably going to pay some probate fees and an attorney and other kinds of things just to make sure that it gets distributed out according to some kind of common law and that the magistrate has to come up with the decisions themselves. At that point, you definitely need a will. But for the vast majority of you, you'd never get to the point that very many of your assets make their way all the way to probate. If it's an insurance policy, or if it's an investment from an insurance policy, or if it's an IRA, or if it's a retirement account like a 403B or a 401K or something like that, it's got a named beneficiary. Now, for good or ill, it's going to that named beneficiary. So now we'll see who runs out of this place really fast to go running back to their insurance agent in a second here. But let's say you had an insurance policy that you got years and years and years and years ago. And you named somebody on that frankly, you wouldn't want to be your beneficiary any longer. they're still going to get the money. I don't care what you put in your will. I don't care what you put in your trust. The insurance company will be legally obliged to go send that money to whoever it was you said was your named beneficiary. And yes, it happens every week in some financial planner's office, somewhere in every major metropolitan area, that somebody discovers that they gave their ex-wife a bunch of money. And the only good news is it, you can't kill the guy a second time for having done it, because he's already dead, and that's how we found out that it was going to happen. So bottom line is, named beneficiaries, highly efficient. Wow, man, you know, no probate court, nobody in between, no lawyers involved. Blunt instruments, though. Highly efficient in the same way a bazooka might be. You wouldn't really want to go quail hunting with one. It gets it done, but it gets it done. So be aware that, you know, you got that list of people, it goes to those people. In that those percentage shares, generally your only choice is, do I give it to them if they die before I do? Do I give it to their progeny or do I not give it to their progeny? Does it go back in and get shared among the remaining beneficiaries, or does it go per stirpes by the bloodline to their kids? Those are about the only choices that you get on those. So it's a blunt instrument, but a highly effective, highly efficient instrument. Transfer on death on titles. You got a house, you got a car, you got a bank account, money market accounts. All of them you can put right on the title who you want it to transfer upon your death. Bypasses probate. The bank is morally obliged, legally obliged. The title department, would just person could take that thing, walk right on up to the title bureau and get whatever, transfer the car into their name, transfer the house into their name. Real simple. Again, pretty blunt instrument. If what you really wanted was your kids to talk about it first, see if maybe they'd keep the family property for the cousins afterward, maybe the opportunity for one party to buy out the other party, to arrange an internal financing, you wanted to use some of your other monies maybe to do that, it ain't happening that way. It was very efficient, but it wasn't very detailed. At that point, when you want some more detail into this, that's where you use a trust. There are two general types of trusts. There's a living trust, which means I didn't give up ownership to it. I just put a set of rules on how it's going to get distributed, or even to some degree, how it's going to get used in life. I may put limitations. In other words, if I put my wife on the as the beneficiary of my trust, but I might be able to add a set of conditions if I wish to that says she's allowed to have income, but she's not allowed to have principal. Or she's allowed to have whatever she needs in what we call HEMS provisions, you know, for her health, education, maintenance, support, but she's not allowed to take it and give it to her new boyfriend. So on and so forth, okay? Trusts give you the opportunity to layer in new sets of rules. These are customized documents that must be done with a qualified estate planning attorney, okay? And if you don't own one, I know one, a bunch of them, that I can point you toward, okay? Irrevocable trust. An irrevocable trust is actually a gift. When you place dollars, you take them, whether that's at the moment of your death, which there's some strategies to be able to do that, or in life, if you put money into a trust that you now can't revoke, you can't change, you can't pull it back out, you made a gift. And you will feel the effects, whatever those might be, of making that gift. From a tax perspective, you have now reduced the amount of money in your lifetime that you're allowed to give and still be free of federal estate tax by whatever that amount of that gift is. So if you put $500,000 into a, be nice that you had the problem, incidentally, but if you put $500,000 into an irrevocable trust, you just took $500,000 out of your $5 million exclusion from federal estate tax to be able to do it. Now, the only place where I am going to advise some of you to go back and take a look at your trusts, or gently, respectfully, work with your parents to look at theirs, if that's your situation, is at the level of the construction of trusts that existed at a time when estate tax was a much more pertinent issue. Many, many, many people still have right now a trust that is in a construction, marital trusts that are in a construction. Sometimes they call them AB trusts, bypass trusts. There's a whole bunch of different names for them. But basically, it involves taking assets at the time of death and splitting them out into pieces so as to lawfully allow each of those pieces, if possible, to get underneath the federal estate tax exclusion. Many of those were written at a time when the federal estate tax exclusion was $600,000. So the documents still look like that. So you may have someone who has a couple million dollars of assets that aren't in any way exposed to federal estate tax right now, but they're going to go through all of these conniptions upon death, moving these dollars into different trusts and putting restrictions on the spouse on the one trust and having the rest for the family. And none of them are necessary any longer if the only reason you were doing it was a federal estate tax that changed. And so it's important for us to look at those trusts. I see those all the time, guys. I probably see, I'm going to guess, three, four a month that I will see of antiquated trusts that either, if I include all the trusts that frankly weren't needed at all, people that went out, went to an attorney because they went to a seminar someplace, usually, I say that somewhat respectfully but somewhat disrespectfully, they went out to a seminar someplace and they heard that they're supposed to have a living trust. And so they have all of the assets that can go into a trust in the living trust. Well, it turns out everything that they own either has a named beneficiary or has titles. They never needed the trust in the first place. Okay? Does that help, whoever asked that question, unless they already left? We talked about powers of attorney. Long-term care insurance I touched upon. I talked about kind of what's going on with that market. The key for long-term care insurance that I would give some additional recommendations to y'all to be thinking about has to do with those statistics we talked about before. Sorry, I know it's late in the early afternoon, I guess, to be talking about those statistics again. But you remember, it pointed out that the relative risk, you don't know whether you're the person or not, okay? But the relative risk is low, okay, for any individual person of having to use any sustained period of long-term care. And that's something that has to get factored in light of the fact that I don't know if I'm that person or I'm not that person. One of the keys to remember, just to give you an idea, the vast majority of long-term care insurance policies, for instance, have what's called an elimination period. It's like a deductible in your other insurance, except it's done in the form of time rather than money. It says, you know what? Even though I'm on claim, even though I'm legit, I've got this disability, for the next 90 days, that's what the standard is in the industry, for the next 90 days, I can't file a claim. I got to hang out for 90 days, pay on my own first before I put it in. Now, many, many insurance agents, rightfully so, will say, well, you know what? Often, commonly, you're in the hospital for a portion of that. You were in a rehab place getting paid for by Medicare for a portion of that. It really didn't make sense for you to pay the extra money to immediately be able to go on claim when it could very well be that you had anywhere from 20 to 100 days of skilled nursing care that you could receive from Medicare. And so they say, hence a 90-day elimination period makes perfect sense. It made your policy cheaper. Let's do that. But we need to recognize that that small number of those folks that are actually going to need, you know, 3 years, 5 years, so on of care, drops dramatically if we remove the folks that only got care for the first 90 days. So the window of exposure to the insurance company dropped dramatically on that. Just as an aside, I generally tend to recommend to people, if you are going to do long-term care insurance, I generally recommend to people that they find a policy that allows you to waive that elimination period for home care. And the reason for that is dementia. Generally, when someone, or other neurological illnesses, when someone has a progressive problem, they don't end up at the hospital for any period of time. They just go on to claim because they can't do things for themselves. And so by getting those dollars into the home immediately, you're getting greater value out of the policy. But there's the bells and whistles of a long-term care policy are substantial. There's many, many, many choices to be made. How much of a benefit? For how long? What additional benefits do I wish to have or do I not wish to have? It is not possible, as if it's possible to do any insurance planning outside of the full financial plan, it is certainly not possible to do a long-term care insurance policy without looking at assets, income, projected situation for retirement, and potential health, chronic health conditions. Can't do it. You've got to do it inside of a plan in order to be able to get something that you're sure is going to make some kind of reasonable value for you. Question was raised about incapacity and incompetence. And so I want to touch upon that just very, very briefly. When I was talking about somebody needing a proxy, having a powers of attorney that go into effect, that's because the person was incapacitated. In other words, they're not able to make decisions on their own. And we would have medical validation to be able to do that. But it's not a legal term. It's a medical term. It is the incapacity. Incompetence is something that actually you are deemed incompetent and hence no longer able to function as a citizen by the probate court and only by the probate court. That's called a guardianship. Now, a guardianship is a pretty substantial... There are people who need a guardianship. They need someone else to literally take over for their needs with or without their consent. When you have a power of attorney, you are acting on behalf of this other person, but you can't be acting in violation of their stated requests, values, affirmations. If you're a guardian, you can. And so hence, in situations of mental illness, situations of progressive dementia that involves psychiatric symptoms, sadly, there are instances where morally we have to take that additional ability to gain, if you will, coercive control over another person's life and act in their best interest even if it is against their will. Now that's got to be judicious, you guys. We got to be really careful. You're talking about really, in that regard, a substantial amount of control and authority in removing. It goes beyond the fact that, they can't vote any longer. It really means that I now have put myself in a position where I actually can coercively gain control over this person. I want to be very careful about that. There are instances where this person would not act in their own best interest. And so I can't just rely on the value of substituted judgment that comes by virtue of that durable power of attorney. I need more authority than that to be able to keep this person safe in most cases. But wow, we got to be careful on that one. And frankly, I have colleagues, particularly medical colleagues, who willy-nilly tell people to head over to the probate court and go get a guardianship. There's a place for it, but it has to be a judicious place. And then, like in any other area where you have been given substantial authority in your life, you place yourself then in submission to other people to make sure that you're handling that authority correctly. And that is true from the guy who's on our pulpit on a Sunday by a Sunday basis in terms of placing himself under the leadership. You hear these names, these people, many of whom are in the UK, okay? Well, what we're saying is the guy that all of us would probably take exactly what he said at face value has systematically put himself in a place where other people have the right to scrutinize him and to call him to task. And then it goes all the way down. There are none of us that live as ultimate judges. Why? Because the scriptures tell us that our hearts are deceived, that they're not trustworthy, that even in the place that we are now with the Holy Spirit in us, that depravity is going to make its way through. And so we live partly in community so as to make sure that the bad part of me doesn't come out and that only the good part of me is able to thrive. And we do that by living in that community. So that kind of authority over another human being's life means that you then place yourself in a higher level of transparency either with your siblings, with your attorney, with your advisor, with your pastor and members of the pastoral staff. But you put yourself in a position because you're now carrying the weight of somebody else's life in that regard. Make sense? Medicaid spend down. Real quick overview on how some of the mechanics, if you guys are game for this, on the Medicaid program. Okay, Medicaid, as you will recall, is the federal state program that provides dollars. It's actually more federal funds than in a state, but it is still administered by the state. Federal state program that provides for public assistance for folks who can no longer afford the cost of their care. There are distinct requirements in terms of income. Generally, a single person should be presumed that they will hand over any income that they have, mailbox money, any income that they have on a monthly basis, depending upon what state you're in, about $40 to $50. And that's for your personal needs. All the rest of it you will kick in first as your monthly, they call patient liability. And then anything of what it costs after that, $5,000, $6,000, $8,000 per year, depending upon what state you're in and what care level you need, the state will pay for the remainder of it. You just had to kick in your part first. If you're a spouse, it's not so clear. And if you're a single person, the assumption is you've already used up all of your dollars down to $1,500 or less in order to be able to have our assistance from the state to provide for the rest of this. So other than the possibility of my, at least 60 months prior, getting rid of my assets and no longer having them count as my assets, there's not a whole lot of options available to a single person. You got to use your stuff first. Okay? There's some ways that we can tweak that to try to massage it around a little bit, but for the most part, really the only option that would have been available is if I thought about ahead enough time, I could have released my ownership of that. And as I shared with you before, we have to ask whether that would have been morally the right thing to do in order to ask for somebody else to pay. Basically, for you to be able to still have those dollars to do something else you wanted with them, in most cases pass them on to your estate. Not a bad thing to do, incidentally, but one that at least we have to consider in light of the fact that now I'm now asking somebody else month after month after month to pay my bills. Okay? So for a single person, the options are relatively limited. For a couple, they are so complicated. They are so much richer. There is an entire section of law around spousal impoverishment. And I cannot minimize for you the amount of complexity, unique individual rules that fall into the life of two spouses. There is the process that was referred to in the question was the Medicaid spend down. And in answer to the question, a single person's Medicaid spend down isn't particularly fancy. They've got to get down to $1,500 or less. There's really not a whole lot of rocket science to it with an individual. They can spend the money on whatever they need to, but they are not eligible for those benefits until the money that they own or have owned in the last 60 months is depleted down to $1,500. Now, there's some modification if they're in a situation where they are cared for by a family member. The law still has a few vestiges of Judeo-Christian values left in it. I mean, that ship sailed a long time ago, but we're still bouncing around occasionally in the wake behind the ship. And one of those elements is that the law states that if a family member moved in and cared for an older adult who otherwise would have been in a nursing care facility, cared for that adult in the 2 years prior to their going into a care facility, that older adult does not necessarily then have to sell the house when they leave it to go to the care facility. That house can go to that caregiver of 2 years, and they can own that house, which is depending upon that, it could be up to, in the state of Ohio, it can be up to $500,000 of value, fair market value, equity value in the house. So it's not a minimal kind of consideration, but the idea was, hey, listen, you kept us off the hook for 2 years by caring for this person. That seems to be the least we can do. It's your house now. You've been living there. You've been caring for that person. So there are a couple of modifications in the rules that are important to know. But spouses are the one where it's most complicated. Spouses are the ones where, let me give a quick example. If a couple has $240,000 or less, use that as your number, then we are in a situation where, let's say they have $200,000, and one of them needs care on an ongoing basis. Certainly, up to $120,000, half of that $240,000 that I talked about. So half of the money that they have belongs to the community dwelling spouse. The other half of the money belongs to the impaired spouse. But the impaired spouse doesn't necessarily have to spend it down on care. They have to spend it down on any number of the allowable categories. What are the allowable categories? The allowable categories could be home improvement for the community dwelling spouse. Could be a home replacement for the community dwelling. I got $100,000 to build, to take care of. I still have to take care of that roof at some point in the next few years. Now would be the time to do that. You know what? I'm going to need for my own self. I'm getting a little creaky. I would need one of those nice bathroom things where I can walk into the shower chair and I'd like one of those things. Okay? Now would be a really good time for you to consider doing that. That last time I'm ever going to do that driveway, let's get the concrete done now. So home improvements, you can imagine a significant amount of money could go into that. Maybe it's like, you know what, I'm not going to make it in this up-down three-story house here on the long run. I think I'd like to move to a condo that would work better for me close to where the care facility is so that I can see my spouse. Perfectly legit. Your housing as a spouse, the security of your housing, is something that we as a society has said we're good with that. You can use some of the money that otherwise would have to go to your wife's care or to your husband's care. You can use it to make sure that you're stable in the community, at least for a while. We think that that's a good thing to do. Furthermore, we know you're going to need transportation. So get rid of that old car you've got and replace it with something nicer, something reliable, We'd like you to do that too. And if it's your car, we don't care what it is. If it's your kid's car, we put some limitations on it, Maserati rules. You know, we want to make sure that you know, it's solely for the purpose of the kid being able to support the parent. But if it's your car, you go ahead. You know, this may be the last car that you're ever going to have. So you go ahead and take care of that. Up to and including, if you're in a situation where you want to bring your spouse out of the care facility on a regular basis, you might want to consider a nice van with a conversion van with a lift on it. Maybe that'll work better for you. Kick it around. See what you want to do. We give you a great deal of freedom. Now, here's the $100,000 guy, right? All of a sudden, can we do the bills in your head? We're bopping through that money pretty quickly. Furthermore, we know at some point you're going to die, both of you, and you're going to need funerals to be paid for. Why don't you go ahead and get a contract, prepay those now, and get the contract so that that'll be taken care of upon each of your deaths? Well, guys, that's another $20,000 to $30,000 easy, depending upon what they're paying for in their funerals. So you can start to see that actually the half for the in a spousal situation, that spend down is actually a significant amount of assets. We're not doing any legal conniptions here. This is nothing crazy. This is what it states in the law and in the Medicaid rules that you're allowed to spend money on in the course of that spend down. You can't keep more than about $120,000 in cash and invested assets. That ain't much in this world. Okay? So, I mean, let's not minimize the fact that when they call it spousal impoverishment, that word is used quite literally. Okay? But we are talking about not having to spend down every dime on the care and leaving the community spouse destitute. Not if we're thinking ahead. Not if we're wise and if we're walking this through. And that's without doing any other more elegant planning than that. That spend down has allowable expenses. I work with a lot of families in this capacity in part because I'm an allowable expense. Them getting counsel from a financial advisor and from an attorney, an accountant, is a perfectly acceptable way of using that half of the spouse's assets because it's seen as something that's going to help your future for the future. Okay? So there is a method to the spend down to be able to qualify for Medicaid. If you wait too long, by definition, you had less money to work with. If right now it's about $120,000 is the max you can keep, which means about $120,000 what the spouse has. So if a couple comes to me and they're at $60,000, $80,000, $100,000, $150,000 of total combined assets, I really wish I'd talked to them last year or the year before that, depending upon what their situation was. Because just under $250,000 is our sweet spot where we can start doing some planning and seeing how we're going to be able to do that kind of spend down. Okay? Last piece is, as I've shared with you before a couple of times, if it's not done correctly, if people transferred assets off, changed ownership, did whatever, intentionally and inadvertently with a lawyer or without a lawyer, if they ended up making an ineligible transfer of assets to another person, they could very well and likely will be deemed as ineligible for Medicaid. And some of you may recall, a few years ago, those rules changed. It's been quite a few years now. It was 2006, 2007. Those rules changed, and everybody thought the big deal was, oh, it used to be a 3-year look back, now it's a 5-year look back. That is true, but that wasn't the big change in the rule. The big change in the rule is, it used to be that the penalty started from the date that you made the gift. No longer. Now the penalty begins from the date that you are otherwise eligible for Medicaid. Yeah, if you're good with math, and I know it's kind of late, but if you think that through, that means the magnitude of the gift could be extraordinary. In other words, if I give away $80,000, and I'll try to do a number that makes more sense. I give away $65,000. And the state's cost of medical care or of care for the average resident is $6,500 each month, okay? Then in 10 months, I've completed fulfilled my penalty. Under the old rules, if I gave the gift 10 months after I gave the gift, as long as I stayed out of the nursing home for 10 months, I was good from the time of giving the gift. Now, it could be many, many, many years later, but less than 5. So it could be 3, 4 years, 4.5 years later. Now I need the care. I come into the Medicaid folks and say, I'm down to my $1,500. I'm otherwise ready to go on to Medicaid. They see the ineligible transfer from 4.5 years before, or basically 4 years, 364 days before, I suppose technically, could be that far. And they say, no, I'm sorry. You gave away $65,000. You have a 10-month waiting period starting from today. 10 months from today at the current cost today of what that penalty is going to be. So if you go to that care facility, and they're not the average cost, they might be $2,000 a month more than the average cost. You got 10 months at $8,000 a month in order to burn off your $65,000 penalty. At $80,000, you've got yourself in worse situation than you started with. So, number one, if you are going to consider the planning of that sort, anything in the way of trying to make yourself intentionally eligible for Medicaid benefits, number one, you must do so with a qualified attorney. Number two, you must do so with a mind toward the morality on this, not just the technical capacity. And you, number three, you must, when I went to the issues of elder care finance, the business of advising people around elder care finance, if all that is involved is creating an irrevocable trust and dumping a bunch of money into it and holding your breath for 60 months, tell me why an attorney would be charging $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 to do that work. What is it about that work? I mean, I've been working with estate planning attorneys and people that write trusts. I mean, irrevocable trusts, don't get me wrong. In order to make them, you know, signed, sealed, and delivered, locked tight, hermetically sealed, there takes some acumen to be able to do that. But you're really talking a couple $1,000s worth of legal work there. What's the extra 10? What's the extra 12 in that? It's the liability that could go bad. It's the possibility that, in fact, if it didn't work out well for the attorney, you're going to sue them for the damages that you have to incur. So they're charging you that additional margin, if you will. Rightfully so, don't get me wrong. They've got to charge you that margin because they're taking on risk in doing this transaction. That may prompt you to stop and say, gee, did I want to do that risky of a transaction? Was I really, is this wise for me to do that, or are there other methods that I could address? In health, those methods might involve insurance. They may involve different ways in which I can organize my portfolio. In illness and acute, it might be worth looking really closely at that whole spend down situation and seeing if I can maximize my situation that way. In either case, Medicaid is a public benefit. It is not a right. It's not the social form of long-term care insurance, public insurance like Medicare or Social Security. It is a benefit program for people who are poor. And it has a set of rules. We've got to follow the set of rules, and then you're entitled to using it. But do be aware, it's not the same as though I'm asserting my right to a pension that was due me. It's a different kind of a approach. Questions? Because those were good ones. Yes, Brenda.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the sake of the recording, Brenda raises, I think, both a practical, as we've tried to today, both a practical and a moral question from a biblical perspective about the viability of the funds that are earmarked for Medicaid. For any given Medicaid beneficiary, there is a social contract with that person to take care of them for the care that they need for the rest of their life. That's the rules. That's a covenant that we've established as a society. And I think it is fair for you for me to say to all of you, you should not be fundamentally concerned that somehow the care of a person receiving Medicaid is any different than the care of the person receiving private pay. But here my caveat. If they're at a really good care facility, they're getting the same really good care as the private pay person is. They might be in a semi-private room instead of a private room, but in terms of the quality and quantity of care they're receiving, it's exactly the same as somebody who's paying full bore for that. If they're at a mediocre or a lousy facility, they're also getting the same mediocre or lousy facility even if they're paying more privately. Okay? That's the nature of nursing and how nursing is organized and how it works within the facility. But Brenda raises, I think, a very legitimate concern about this is a, if you will, fixed pool of funds, at least in the way that we structure our public finances. In the same way we talk about, if I open that up and said, well, yeah, it's a fixed pool of funds from which we could also draw the military budgets, from which we also draw subsidies to states for some really good projects and some bridges that don't go anyplace. That's a broader question of, as citizens, that we should be looking at. But at a very fundamental level, I think morally, what you're touching upon is something that, that authors have referred to as the common, or the tragedy of the common, right? I mean, I think we used to have one in Public Square downtown a long, 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 long time ago. If you go to like the City Club or something, or you'll see. But in any case, the common is the idea that there's a, you could bring your livestock in to a central place and share that patch of land, and your livestock can feed while you're going negotiating the sale for them. And of course, the understanding is, I'm not going to eat up all of the grass here with my guys. Because if my sheep eat all the grass, I just create an incentive that the next time you're going to make sure your sheep eat up the grass first. And so that if I break the social covenant, it means it's open that everybody else is going to break it too, just to keep even and just to keep up. That would be, at a fundamental moral level, that would be the social concern that we would have. In fact, is the Medicaid budget a tragedy of the commons, where, in a manner of speaking, you're using a potentially limited resource, and that means you've increased the likelihood that the next guy is going to arm up with his attorney to go use it ahead of you. And it's a mad race to who can get this free money first. It's not very good public policy. It probably isn't the way that we as a body of Christ, I believe, are supposed to be behaving relative to the state. It is certainly an area for us to make sure that we are being prayerfully discerning. Thanks, Brenda. That was a good point to close us on. I'm going to call it quits, okay? You guys get out of here. And you went far longer than you were supposed to, so take care.